overpoweringly fresh shit. "Fats," I said from the doorway. "Meet Barry." "What?" asked Fats, surprised. "Oh, no." "Hello, Barry. Bash, you schlemiel, you don't want her to see this. Get out of here. I'll be with you in a minute."
"I'm here to see," said Barry. "Tell me what you're doing."
She went in. Fats began to tell her what they were doing, but when the waves of smell hit her, Barry covered her mouth and rushed out of the room. Fats turned on me angrily. "Bash, sometimes you act like a Marine at brain rest, a retard. Teddy, finish up. I've got to talk to the poor woman saddled with young numbskull Bash."
When Barry came out of the ladies, she looked like she'd been crying. Seeing Fats, she said, How can you? It's disgusting."
"Yeah," said Fats. "It is. How can I? Well, Barry, when we get old and disgusting, who's going to doctor us? Who's going to care? Someone's got to do it. We can't just walk away." Looking sad, he said, "Seeing you react this way brings back just how disgusting it is. It's awful. We're forced to forget." So come on," he said, putting his thick arm around her shoulders. "Come on into my office. I got a special stash of Dr. Pepper. At times like this, a Dr. Pepper helps." They started for the on-call room, and I followed, saying, "Great case, Fats. You know, Barry, most people are like you and me. They hate shit. But Fats loves it. Going into GI work himself."
"Stop it, Roy," Barry snapped.
"When a GI man is looking up the barrel of a sigmoidoscope, you know what you got?"
"Stop it! Go away! I want to talk with Fats alone."
"Alone? Why?"
"Never mind. Go away."
Angry and jealous, I watched them walk off, and I yelled after them, "You got shit looking at shit! That's what!" Fats turned and angrily said, "Don't talk like that."
"Hurt your feelings, Fats?"
"No, but it hurts hers. You can't use our inside jokes with the ones outside all this. The ones like her."
"Sure you can," I said. "They need to see..."
"They don't," yelled Fats. "They don't need to, and they don't want to. Some things have to be kept private, Bash. You think parents want to hear school teachers making fun of their kids? Use your damn head. You got a good woman here, and believe me, they are not easy to find and keep, especially if you're a doctor. It makes me angry to see the way you treat her." An hour later, they paged me to come in. It felt like a military tribunal. Barry said she and Fats were worried about me, about my bitter sarcasm and rage. "I thought you told me to express what I feel," I said.
"In words," said Barry, "not in acts. Not in taking it out on patients and doctors. Fats told me about your rumor about Dr. Putzel."
"They'll get you, Roy," said Fats. "You'll get it in the neck. They can't do anything to me. They can't run the house without interns. I can do whatever I want. I'm indispensable, invulnerable. It's dangerous. Externalization is a brittle defense."
"Here we go again," I said. "What's externalization?"
"Seeing the conflict as outside of you."
"The problem isn't outside of you. It's inside. When you see that, something's going to snap."
"That's the way it's gotta be, to survive."
"It's not. Look at Fats. He's got a healthy way of dealing with this incredible situation. He uses compassion, humor. He can laugh."
"I can laugh," I said. "I laugh too."
"No, you don't. You scream. You're the one who used to call him cynical, sick. And he's the one who taught me to call these nice old people gomers. He hasn't killed off the caring part of himself. You have."
"Look," said Fats seriously, "let's stop, huh? We can't tell him what to do. If you can imagine it, last year I was a hell of a lot worse than him, and nobody could tell me anything. Even last July, I was worse. This year is yours, Roy. I know how it is. It's hell."
This Putzel thing scares me, said Barry.
Why him?
Because every day he stands in front of his mirror, and straightening his bow tie, he says to himself, You know, Putzy Poops, you are one great physician. Not a good physician, no, a great physician.
I hate him.
You think you're scared? You should see him, shaking in his shoes, ready to crack.
Ha!
It's not Putzel, it's you, said Barry. You hate something inside of you. Get it?
I don't, and it's not. Fats knows what an asshole Putzel is.
Don't do it, Roy, said Barry. You'll only hurt yourself.
Fats?
Putzel's a turkey, said Fats. A money-grubbing, incompetent piece of dreck.
True.
But he's not the monster you're making him out to be. He's a harmless wimp. I feel sorry for him. Lay off. Whatever you're planning, don't do it.
I did it.
I'd given the rumor a week to gnaw on Putzel. My time had come. I found Putzel holding a rose's hand, and I crept up in back of him. I whispered in his ear, I've had it with you, Putzel. Within the next 24 hours, I swear, I'm going to do you in. Putzel leaped up off the bed, gave me a panic-stricken look, and ran out of the room. I walked out into the corridor and watched the little emperor of the bowel run, keeping his back to the walls and intermittently ducking into doorways as if he were afraid of a bullet, race off down the hall. I ambled off toward rounds. I never made it. Two bouncers from house security attacked me, twisted my arms behind me, and carried me into the on-call room. They stood me up against the wall and frisked me for a weapon and sat me down facing Lionel, Fish, Fats, and quaking in a corner, Putzel.
Hey, what the hell's going on? I asked.
And everyone looked at Putzel until he said, I heard a rumor about some intern was going to kill me, and then he whispered in my ear that in the next 24 hours he was going to do me in. I waited until the silence had become unbearable. And then, in a calm voice, I said,
What did you say?
You said you were going to do me in.
Dr. Putzel, I asked incredulously, have you gone mad?
You said it. I heard you say it. Don't deny it to me. I denied it to him, said that anyone who thought that an intern in the House of God would threaten to kill a private doctor of the House of God had gone mad, and told the bouncers to let me go.
No, don't let him go,
screamed Putzel, hugging the wall like a terrified maniac.
Look, I said, I'm just an intern trying to do my job. I can't take responsibility for that nut.
See you later, huh?
No, no,
wailed Putzel, rolling his eyes like a nut.
What do you think we should do?
The bouncers asked the fish.
I don't know, said the fish.
Fats?
I've never seen anything like this, said Fats.
One thing's for sure. Dr. Putzel is acting mighty strange.
It's the strangest thing, said the Lego as I sat in his office, which was the only place they decided it was safe to send me. Yes, the strangest.
And he drifted off into that place out his window, where the answers to strange things might be found.
I mean, you didn't, in fact, threaten to kill...
Oh, of course you didn't, said the Lego, his consternation turning his horrific birthmark even more purple. How could I have, sir?
Exactly. It's extraordinary.
Can I speak in confidence?
Fire away, he said, bracing himself for yet another shock.
To me, this means that Dr. Putzel is a sick man.
Sick? A house private sick, Roy?
Overworked. Needs a rest. And who doesn't, sir? Who doesn't? The chief paused, as if perplexed, and then brightened and came up with the answer.
Why, no one doesn't. No one doesn't at all. I'll tell Dr. Putzel he needs a rest just like everyone else. Thanks, Roy. And keep right on in there plugging.
Plugging? For what?
For what? Why... Why, for the awards. Yes, keep plugging for the awards.
I felt good. Maybe I even felt grand. My only twinge of regret was that I had stepped out on my own, leaving behind Barry and Fats, the ones who claimed to care, the ones I'd counted on to save me. Chapter 17. It was all the rage, that Watergate march, and many great Americans took the opportunity to explode. Jane Doe, bloated and floated by the infusion of the VA antibiotic, started with a little squeeping fart caught on the fat man's alert stopwatch, and then, with the rest of us watching, went on to rage at us with a great cacophony of orchestrated farts, and then liquid farts, and finally a blasting of her bowels and a continual gushing of what seemed like eternal stool. Richard Nixon, bloated by power and doubt, started with a little bark when named by Judge Sirica as an unindicted co-conspirator of the Watergate boys, and went on to rage in a farting cornucopia on national TV, convincing almost every great American by his overreaction and gushing paranoiac railing at other great Americans that he was as guilty as anyone had imagined. We were all much relieved that no matter what else, we'd all have Nixon to laugh at and kick around for quite a good while longer. In some ways, after Vietnam, it was just what the country needed, a president so lacking in grace. In Gomer City, we turns exploded as well. First to go was Eat My Dust Eddie. Bent under his own sadomasochism, he broke. He took himself OTC on every Gomer until his service was being run by his BMS, and Eddie would talk about Gomers only in terms of, how can I hurt this guy today, or some of them want us to kill them and some of them don't, and I wish they'd make up their minds, 'cause it gets confusing. The BMS couldn't stand the strain, and soon gave in to Eddie's perverted thoughts. And one day, when a particularly recalcitrant Gomer shrieked, "Police! Police!" for several hours, Eddie and his BMS borrowed uniforms and appeared at the bedside and said, "Yes, madam, this is Patrolman Eddie and Officer Katz. What can we do to help?" "Why are you tormenting them?" Fats would ask. "'Cause they're tormenting me," Eddie would say. "They've got me on my knees, do you hear me? On my knees!" When his wife started to have labor pains, all hell broke loose. The day his wife delivered, Eddie showed up dressed in his black motorcycle gear, hat and boots and black wraparound reflecting sunglasses and black leather jacket with "Eat My Dust Eddie" in silver studs on the back, and went around to see his Gomers with his flash camera, taking portraits to remember them by. The place came apart. Terrified, the Gomers began to shriek. The ward began to sound and smell like a zoo. Every house hierarchy sent a representative, and we found Eddie sitting calmly in the on-call room, boots up on the desk, grinning ear to ear and reading Rolling Stone. To any inquiries, all he would say was, "They've broken me. I'm OTC." Later, when he asked me if I thought he was being unreasonable, against my better judgment, thinking of what he'd said to me when I was banging on the elevator door, I said, "Unreasonable? Ha! I think you were giving them just what they always deserved." "He's crazy," I said to Fats. "Yeah, delusional. A paranoid psychosis. It's terrible to watch." "Ah, well, Bash, they'll have to give him a rest." "They can't," I said. "There's no one to fill in for him." "No one doesn't need a rest," said the Lego to the fish, as they discussed what to do about Eddie. "No one at all. Why, look at poor Dr. Putzel. I'll tell Eddie he needs a rest, just like everyone else."
"And who will fill in for him?" asked the fish.
"Who? Why, the others. My boys will all pitch in and help."
The next day, Eddie was not at the card flip, and when I called him at home, he said, "I'm OTC for a while."
I'm sorry to do this to you guys, but the Lego won't let me back into the house. He thinks if I stayed there any longer, I might kill one of the Gomers and the house would get sued. He might just be right.
Yeah, I said. Let's face it. You were getting close.
Wouldn't be a bad idea, though, would it?
It's illegal. How's the baby?
Oh, you mean the Gomer, Eddie said.
The Gomer?
Yeah, the Gomer. Incontinent of feces and urine, unable to walk or talk, not oriented, and sleeping in restraints at night. The Gomer. Roommate 11. I don't know how she is, because they won't let me into the house to see her.
They won't let you see your own baby?
Yeah. I told them I wanted to take some pictures, and they took away my camera, so I'm temporarily OTC with my own baby Gomer, too. The fish told Hooper and me that to pitch in and help take up the slack created by Eddie's snapping, he and the Lego had decided we would be on call every other night for our last weeks on Gomer City, but that we get special consideration.
Oh, Christ, I said. I hope it's not the Tuffies again.
Not the Tuffies, said the fish. The preferential treatment. Preferential treatment was being skipped in the admission rotation once per day. This sounded good until it turned out that skipping a daytime admission resulted in our being awakened at 3 a.m. for the Gomer beelining it in from Mount St. Elsewhere via the grenade room to Gomer City, courtesy of Marvin and the Blazers. Every other night, this 3 a.m. special was the worst. After a week of the preferential treatment, Umberto and Teddy and I were going almost as mad as Eddie. Teddy was the first to go. His ulcer had started to act up, muttering something about the cramps, or maybe the camps. He left. Next to go for me was Molly. Strained by Gomer City, my thing with Molly had been fading for months. And when the preferential treatment had me on call for 36 hours and off for 12, outside the house all I did was sleep. Once in a while I'd see Molly on the upstairs ward, and it was clear that she was losing interest in me. One day I found Howard helping her to make up a bed. I was shocked. Hot oil and myrrh for Howie? I asked Molly what was going on.
Well, yes, I've been seeing Howard Greenspoon. He's the turn on this ward now.
I guess I can't understand you anymore, Roy.
What do you mean?
You've become so cynical. You make fun of these poor patients.
Everyone makes fun of these poor patients.
Not Howard Greenspoon. He treats them with respect. I mean, it's like you're making fun of what I do. Remember how you walked out of that arrest on the man dying from multiple myeloma?
Yeah, but it was a big mess.
Maybe. But Howard stayed right until the end.
Howie? You and me used to make fun of Howie, I said.
Maybe so, but people change, you know. Look, I've had to work hard to get where I am. I can't help it if things always came easy to you and you just coasted into medicine. When you were getting patted on the head, I was getting whacked by the nuns. Do you know how big and scary a nun all in black is to a little girl? Probably not. Well, Howard says he does.
He does, I said, thinking maybe Howie wasn't such a dumb schnook after all.
He certainly does. He's sincere. No one could call you that.
So I've got to hand in my gold cleats, huh?
Oh, Roy, she said, remembering the loving, snuggling up to me. I don't know. I still care. I guess it depends on what Howie says.
Jesus! My myrrh depended on Howie. Howie, the turn who felt like a hero every time he put a feeding tube down someone's demented grandmother, who puffed up with pride when he marched into an elevator filled with non-doctors and heard the whispers, "There's one of them, a doctor." Howie, who bought the fantasies that doctors weren't just people, doctors were better people. Howie, who would woo Molly and do all those sexual things he'd only imagined doing,
with Molly.
And think he loved Molly, and get back at his parents by marrying Molly the Shiksa nurse, and have three kids, and then... And then 15 years down the pike, when Molly awoke, and realized that by marrying Howie she was only getting back at the nuns, and what the hell, why not fuck with the macho guy who came to repair her washer-dryer, and why not leave Howie? And then, 15 years down the pike, Howie, awakening to the notion that as a husband, father, lover, he'd been screwed by his fanatic dedication to medicine, and that even in medicine he couldn't cure anyone of anything, he'd check into the motel room alone, and for the first time in his life, in shock, have to haggle out his one real decision. Whether or not to peg out painlessly with the 5 grams of phenobarb he'd lifted from the hospital pharmacy when he'd found out that his wife and kids had left. Should I fight? Should I challenge Howie for Molly? Nah. It was too much of an effort now. And she was right. I'd become too cynical, too destructive for her. Hyper Hooper and I cried differently from Eat My Dust. Although Death and Hooper were still going steady, and with Eddie on a pit stop at home, Hooper was racing even harder for the Black Crow. Under the stress of Gomer City, Hooper had begun acting like a Gomer. He'd gotten thin, almost scrawny, and neglected his personal hygiene. He began to rock like a schizophrenic or an old Jew at prayer. Having lost his wife, he was now losing his pathologist. On occasion, I'd find him sleeping next to Jane Doe in an armchair recliner, mouth in O sign. And when the fish insisted we go on walk rounds, Hooper would slip into a wheelchair and wheel himself around, singing Jane's chromatic scale. If the fish reprimanded him, he'd turn and say, "Physician, wheel thyself." The real problem arose when Hooper took to sleeping in the electric Gomer beds in restraints. And one day when I came in and found him in an ankle cast and asked him what had happened, he said only, "Gomers go to ground." He'd done just that, fracturing a small bone in his ankle, which enabled him to make rounds in his wheelchair every day. Our final explosion took place at one sociable C round. Rocking, chattering, punning, laughing, Hooper and I managed to blast every house hierarchy. We fought with Lionel over perverted Sam, the man who ate everything, who, when we'd found him eating our food stashes day after day, we'd turfed directly out to the icy street and refused to readmit. The Blazers had readmitted him to floor 8, trying to convince us to take him back. When Selma, amazed, asked Lionel, who was taking care of him, with his diabetes and his sexual perversions, Lionel had said, "We are, the staff of help." "You?" asked Selma. "Help is treating his diabetes? That's illegal." I perked up and said, "From what I know of those petunias in help, Selma, they may not know how to treat his diabetes, but they sure as hell will get off on his perversions." Lionel got up to storm out, and lying down on my back in his path, I cried out, "Help, Selma, help!" I looked up, and all I saw was blue blazers. We antagonized Sally and Bonnie for stopping Eddie's turf of the Lady of the Lice. He'd neglected to put down on her 3-part placement form who would meet her in St. Louis, mentioning in passing the word cunts, which sent both of them and our female BMS flying out of the room. Finally, the meeting turned to mayhem, when Hooper and I began rocking in sync and muttering, "Autoeroticism, the only way." The fish, eyes popping like a red snapper's, took charge and organized a stat field trip to Chinatown for lunch. How could we have known that during our happy Chinese lunch, a rumble had begun in the House of God, and that this rumble had already begun feeding into older, deeper rumbles within the Lego, our chief? Each affronted hierarchy had given the Lego a buzz, and he was enraged. Returning to the house, fat and happy. Imagine our surprise when we saw the Lego appear at the far end of the corridor, rolling toward us. As he came closer and closer, we could see that he had a smile on his face that no one had ever seen before. Trembling, the fish turned to Hooper and me, said, "You'd better watch out, guys. You're really going to get it." Amazed and surprised, Hooper and I stared at each other. In his eyes was reflected my own incomprehension. Why would the Lego get us? What was so bad about what we had done? We braced ourselves for the shock. The stiff legs moved closer, the raging smile spread wider, until it looked as if it would split the tight face open and spill whatever hid under that purple birthmark right out onto the floor of Gomer City. When he was so close I could read the brand name on his stethoscope as it ducked down into the jungle of his genitals, in a bizarre fashion that might have been the MSG in the Chinese food, not one, but two arms swiveled, and two long hands reached out and came to rest on two scapulae, one of the fat man and one of the fish. Staring at them, Lego demanded, "Who is responsible? Someone is responsible for these poor interns, for this disaster of a ward. It is my job to find out who. You two, come with me." "It took all I had," said Fats afterward. "But I did manage to finesse him, at least most of him." Logically, he was trapped. He had two choices: take it out on you interns, or take it out on the ones responsible for you turns. Having already lost Eddie, it was clear that he couldn't take it out on you. He had to take it out on those responsible. While I may be responsible for you, it is also true that the fish is responsible for me. And guess who is responsible for the fish?
The chief.
Exactly. So he was stuck. I managed to finesse that part, the logic. But I couldn't finesse what the Lego felt. You see, the Lego didn't mind what you'd done to the Lady of the Lice, or to Sam the Hungry Pervert, Putzel, the Blazers, the Nurses, the BMSs, to Tina, or Harry, or Jane, or the roses that Hooper keeps killing. He didn't even mind your setting house records for lowest temperature in a living human being, most organs hit with a single needle shot, or most tests of the bowel run in a single night. In many ways, he thought you'd done a terrific job, especially as regards postmortems. But the thing that he was bullshit about was you guys not liking him. He can't stand your being cool toward him. He suspects you even make fun of him behind his back. Imagine that. When you show him you don't like him, you hit a nerve, and when that happens, he goes ape. No one can finesse the ape. Pensively, Fats went on. Of course, for my share of the responsibility, he's delaying writing my fellowship letter again. I keep worrying that it'll be Samoa. The last thing he said to me was, "Whatever you boys do, don't do anything else. Do nothing. Understand?" Imagine him saying that to me. "You told him, of course," I said, "that doing nothing was your greatest invention. The delivery of medical care." "Right. Why stop at Samoa? Go for broke and get the gulag." Fats fell silent. Hooper left, and I asked Fats what was on his mind. "Well, maybe this is more serious than I think. Maybe this is trouble. All the way from Brooklyn, all those exams and scrabbling, all that effort to land me here in the big time, on the verge of the big Hollywood, hello, Fats. And I just had the thought that maybe it'll all fall down. And I don't like it. This may be goodbye, L.A., goodbye, dreams. Sometimes it seems like it just doesn't pay, does it, Bash?"
"Does what?"
"To imagine. To dream." Potts stood before me in the darkness of 2 a.m. in Gomer City. And mirrored in his gray face was, as always, the yellow man. "What are you doing here at this hour?" I asked. But he didn't reply. He just stood there, staring. Again, I asked what was going on. "The yellow man just died." I felt a chill. Potts looked white and chill, and his eyes looked dull and dead, and I said, "I'm sorry. I mean, I'm really sorry." "Yeah," said Potts, fidgeting, as if he wasn't really in the same world with me any longer. "Yeah. Well, he was going to die. It was just a matter of time." "Yeah, he was," I said. And I thought about how much torment Potts had gone through every day that the yellow man had been alive. "Are you all right?" "Who, me?" "Oh, yeah, I am. It's just a little hard. I didn't ask for a post. I didn't want to get one," said Potts, almost pleading with me that it was all right. "It's okay. I know how you feel. I didn't ask for a post on Dr. Sanders."
"Sit down and talk about it, huh?"
"No, I think I'll just go upstairs and see him once more, and then maybe take a walk." "Right. I'll be down here if you change your mind."
"Thanks."
"You know, I should have given him the steroids."
"Stop it. Nothing would have helped."
"Yeah, well, steroids might have helped. Well, anyway, we sure had some fun the other night with Otis, didn't we?"
"Sure did, Wayne. We'll do it again, huh?"
"Yeah. Soon. If I can find the time." As I watched him slip away down the corridor and disappear into the up elevator, I thought of the fun we'd had. I'd gone over to his house, and although it was depressing, with the place a mess and with that loaded revolver by the bed, Potts and I had taken Otis out for a run in the March chill, and we talked about the South. Potts had told me about Mrs. Bagley's dancing class, held at the country club every Friday night. Mrs. Bagley, an immigrant, would come out in a chiffon dress with a cinched waist and pop the needle into the groove, and out would come the Shirelles. They learned to dance, pressing a walnut between their noses. And the big event, year after year, was on the last Friday night, when Potts and his less tame but still old family buddies would roll BB pellets onto the polished oak floor during a slam-banging 1-2-3, 1-2-3 roll-out-the-barrel polka. I thought it strange that day that Potts hadn't even mentioned his father's recent violent death. I realized suddenly what was going to happen. Fool! I ran to the elevator and pounded on it, but it wasn't moving, and I raced up the stairs to floor 8, and I kept cursing myself for not realizing it in time and praying that I had, or that I was wrong. I was not wrong. While I'd been cradled in his reminiscences of Mrs. Bagley's, Potts had taken the elevator straight to floor 8, had opened a window, and had thrown himself out to his death. From the window I saw the splattered mess on the parking lot below, and in between my panting for breath and shivering in the chill draft, I heard the first siren squeal. And I leaned my forehead on the sill, and I sobbed. "Did he leave a note?" asked Barry.
"Yeah, it was pinned to the yellow man, and it said, 'Feed the cat.'"
"There was no cat."
"What did it mean?"
"It was meant for Joe. When Potts and Chuck and I were together with Joe upstairs, Joe kept niggling Potts to take better care of his patients. To feed the cat. Joe said that if Potts had been on his toes, the yellow man mightn't have died." I found myself thinking of Potts as a tragic figure. A guy who'd been a happy, tow-headed kid you'd love to take fishing with you, who'd mistakenly invested in academic medicine when he'd have been happy in his family business, and who'd become a splattered mess on the parking lot of a hospital in a city he despised. What had been the seductiveness of medicine?
Why?
"They killed him."
"Who did?" asked Barry.
"Joe, the fish, the others." While most of us in the house felt empty and didn't know what to say or do, Others had definite ideas. Jo, perhaps thinking of her own pop's leap from a bridge to his death, raised the question of the post-mortem exam to find out if there had been any organic precipitant. The fish talked to us in a heartfelt way about how suicide is always an existential alternative. Belego seemed upset, puzzled that one of his boys, especially one who he'd thought had loved him more than most, had killed himself. He talked about the pressures of the internship year and about the waste of a great talent. Belego reassured us that he wanted to give us some time off to mourn. However, he could not do this. In fact, we'd all have to work a little harder to fill in. You'll all have to pitch in and help. Like many other events in the House of God, this response from our leaders seemed so crass as to be imagined. If imagined, however, it had been imagined by us all. No one mentioned how the House medical hierarchy had tormented Potts with the yellow man, how it had ignored his pain. We tried hard to forget Potts fast, but for the longest time we could not. For every day when we parked our cars in the parking lot, we saw and tried our hardest to avoid the little blotchy discoloration on the asphalt. None of us wanted to run over Potts with our cars, even if he was already dead. At first, there was good reason to avoid the blotch, for there was real blood there, and bits of hair and bone stuck to the thawing asphalt. As we tried to avoid it, the parking problem increased, and the house sent out some of housekeeping to scrub it off. Try as they might, though, although they washed away the hair and bone, they had a lot of trouble washing away the discoloration. Sure, it got lighter and lighter, but the hooker was that it also got spread wider and wider over the lot so that it became more and more difficult to avoid it. And we all felt, every day, that we were scrambling to avoid parking on Potts. Everyone tried to park on the perimeter of the lot. Some showed up early so as not to have to park in the middle. All in all, it was a worse reminder than before they had spread Potts around. Each of us took the nebulous and faint discoloration and created out of it first an image of bone and blood and bits of hair, and then an image of Potts falling, and then of Potts leaping out, and finally, sadly, of Potts alive. And then, at last, of Potts alive and being crushed by guilt for not having given the yellow man the roids. Thinking of how they had tormented Potts until he had bought it, we got mad, for many of us thought that of all of us, Potts, with his compassion and gentleness, might have become a wonderful doc. Of all of us, he was dead. Outrageous. "What's suicide about?" I asked Barry. "Here," she said, drawing me to her. "Put your head here. Close your eyes. What are you feeling?" "Blank." "Then fury." "I'm pissed. I'm so furious I could kill." "That's what suicide's about. Under incredible pressure, alone, with no support from your bosses, most of you have found bizarre ways. This role labeling of Hooper with death and the runt with sex. To project your anger outside yourselves." "Potts didn't. He never acted strange. He never got mad. He took his rage and blasted himself. Introjection. The opposite of what you do, Roy." "What do I do?" "You rail at everything. You're sarcastic. And even though you're pretty obnoxious, it's the one way you've chosen to survive." "Survive?" "It was not at all certain that I would survive Gomer City. I didn't know much of anything anymore, but I knew that I was in big trouble and acting crazy, and that I didn't really care." Fats and I sat in the on-call room. In the air was death. Fats looked sad, and I asked him what he was thinking. "Grenade room doubler and his HTE service," he said.
"HTE service?"
"Yeah. Hold the elevator service. When Doubler was here in Gomer City, he got so fed up, so the rumor goes, that he knocked off the Gomers at a terrific clip. He used intravenous KCL because it can't be detected at autopsy.
Whenever he took the elevator down, he'd shout out, "Hold the elevator," and would wheel in a corpse and ride down with it to the morgue. They say Dubler seldom made the trip down alone.
What? He knocked off the Gomers?
Rumor, Bash, rumor. We sat there together, my mind on this HTE service, and Saul the Tailor and Wayne Potts. I felt numb. After a few minutes, I looked up. The fat man was crying. Quiet tears filled his eyes. Fat, wet tears of desperation and loss. They rolled down his cheek. He sat still, a hero, overcome. "Why are you crying?"
"Roy, I'm crying for Potts.
And I'm crying for myself. From far off, I heard a tune in my head. Not the bright, thunderous Sousa marches blared out by the trombones and crunched by the cymbals as the glittering marching band was led down the street by a miracle like Molly, no. No, seeing the fat man crying, the tune I heard was the one always played by a lone bugler and wafted out over a grassy knoll littered with alabaster slabs, heard by those weeping as the Kennedy widows and orphans had wept. A tune of an immense, numb solitude. Taps. Saul the Leukemic Tailor was going through hell. Everyone, including the cheery oncologist who'd failed to cure his leukemia, had given up on him and was waiting for him to die. In coma, he was dying slowly and could last for a long time. The worst part was that he was in terrible pain, his poisoned bone marrow sending shocks and screams straight through his heart and head, and it all came out in moans and tears. Saul didn't shriek. Saul cried. It wasn't a natural human crying, for several strokes had obliterated his human sleep cycle so that he never slept. The crying was continuous, animal, moans of pain, streaks of tears on cheeks. It was driving everyone mad. I hated it. I hated him. Without much thought, raging inside, one night I snuck into the medicine cabinet, got the KCL and syringe, and made sure that no one saw me enter Saul's room. He lay there in his own feces, a mass of tubing and tape and bruises and rotted skin and empty bone poking through at the ribs and elbows and knees. I thought of what I was about to do. I stopped. A memory of Dr. Sanders's death rushed through me, and I saw him oozing blood and saying, "God, this is off." And I heard Saul saying to me, "Finish me off. Do I have to beg you? Finish me off." I caught myself thinking of Potts. Saul screamed. Angrily, I uncapped the syringe and found the IV outlet and pushed in enough KCL to kill him. I watched him gasp for breath as his heart depolarized. And I watched his breathing become laborious and his hand give a little twitch. And then a stillness come over him. A peace. But for his agonal breathing, which seemed to last a long time, I put the light out and went to be somewhere by myself. I was paged by the night nurse. Saul was dead. On St. Patrick's Day, I was called down to the EW late at night as part of the preferential treatment that the fish had invented to turn us into lunatics, and I was startled to see a sideshow row of what had to be the worst patients in the world. A dead nun being resuscitated by Chuck. A homosexual murderer turfed in from prison who thought his turn, the runt, despite his mustache, was a girl. Two roommates who'd overdosed on heroin and were dying. Many Gomers. I picked up my admissions chart and headed for the grenade room. I wondered where Fats was, but I didn't really care. And I didn't have to wonder long.
because I opened the door and saw Fats and Umberto and the two policemen in what looked like green uniforms because it was St. Paddy's Day, and a gomer named what else but Rose, and with Fats and Umberto covered in vomit and feces and urine and blood.
"A great and a grand good evening to you," said Gilhenny, drunkenly waving a shillelagh. "And it is true that good officer Quick and I have been well on duty pouring Guinness stout into our bodies and are inebriated."
"For work has the curse of the drinking man," said Quick.
"And to celebrate the man who drove the snakes from Ireland," said the redhead, "we have found a fitting rose."
With the help of the fat man and Umberto, they hoisted the rose up to a sitting position, and I saw that they had pinned a green sign edged with shamrocks to her nightie, and the sign said, "Kiss me, I'm Irish." I started to laugh, and slipped on a turd and fell down in the doorway. I lay there in the filth, laughing, and the fat man came over to me and bent over me and waved a little test tube under my nose and said, "See this? This is all the urine she's made in 5 days, and half of this is the diuretic I gave her. A bed has been sold forever. She's had 5 courses of electroshock therapy for depression, the last in 1947. A shriek came from the gomer. "Ree, ree, ree!" And all I did while they stared at me was lie on the tile floor and laugh. Her neck is so stiff she can lie with her head off the bed and with no pillow, without pain, said Fats. She is unresponsive to everything we've tried. Ree, ree, ree! And I lay on the floor and laughed. I stuck a tongue blade in her mouth and she sucked on it so hard I still haven't been able to pull it out, and neither has anyone else. She has the strongest suck reflex in history, which means, of course, that there is no frontal lobe function. No frontal lobe function at all. And you know why? Because she had a lobotomy in 1948. Ho, ho, hoo! And I lay down and laughed and laughed. The ultimate gomer. And you, you MVI, you, she's totally and completely yours. Hoo! Ree, ree, ree! And all I could do then, tears streaming down my cheeks, realizing that these gomers had won, that they had outlasted me and would survive in Gomer City after I'd gone in 2 weeks and left all of them to try to break my replacement, Howie. And all I could do then, crying, was lie in the shit on the floor and laugh. I couldn't laugh when I realized that Potts was gone, and Dr. Sanders was still gone, and Saul was gone, and Molly was going with Howie, and Eat My Dust Eddie was gonzo gone, and Hyper Hooper was more or less gone, and Teddy was gone, and half of Teddy's stomach was gone, and the fat man was soon really going a long way away from me on his fellowship wherever, and that the only ones who weren't gone were the Gomers. I had yet to see a gomer die in the house of God, unless it was with the aid of Hyper Hooper's needle shots, or the dummies in dialysis who'd shrunk fast Tina's brain down to the size of a pea. And what the hell, mistakes do happen, don't they? Almost anyone I cared about was gone, exploded into a billion corpuscular fragments like a great American grenade might explode in Vietnam, with the shrapnel raining down like confetti, except that it wasn't at all like nice, soft, red, white, and blue confetti, because it brought you to your knees, and broke you, and hurt you, and left wounds that wouldn't heal, and watery, poisoned blood that wouldn't clot, and would never wash out of your whites, and images that wouldn't fade, like the discoloration on the parking lot that had once been Wayne Potts. We were mostly gone. Caught in a net of silence and pain where it might just be that the dead did lie, restless, and even in death, fearing worse death or something worse. I lay on top of my bed. Barry came in. I was silent. Barry sat on the edge of my bed and talked to me,
but I was silent. I was not tired, or sad, or mad. She cradled my head in her lap and looked into my eyes and started to cry. She tried to leave. She came back a couple of times between the doorway and the bed, and finally, hesitating at the door a final time, like a mourner might hesitate before allowing the casket to be closed, she left. Her sad footsteps echoed down the stairs and died. And I did not feel sad. I was not tired or mad. I lay on top of my bed and did not sleep. I imagined I felt what the Gomers felt, an absence of feeling. I had no idea how bad I might be, but I knew that I could not do what Dr. Sanders had told me to do, to be with others. I could not be with others, for I was somewhere else, in some cold place, insomniac in the midst of dreamers, far, far from the land of love. Part 3. The Wing of Zoc. But how is the poor wretch to acquire the ideal qualifications that he needs in his profession? Sigmund Freud. Analysis Terminable and Interminable. Chapter 18. I was ready to be taken over by machines. On the morning of April Fool's Day, I found myself just outside the hermetically sealed double doors of the MICU, the Medical Intensive Care Unit, what the fat man had called that mausoleum down the hall. Like a suburbanite in a fugue state who starts out heading for Wall Street and turns up 3 days later, blank, in Detroit, I had no past or future. I was merely there. I felt scared. For the next month, I would have to take responsibility for the intensive care of those perched precariously on the edge of that slick bobsled ride down to death. I would be on call every other night, alternating with the resident. A bronze wall plaque caught my eye. Through the munificence of Mr. and Mrs. G. L. Zoc, 1957. Zoc of the Wing of Zoc? When would I meet a real Zoc? With the technocratic dispassion of an astronaut, I pushed through the double doors, sealing myself hermetically in. The inside was ultra-quiet, ultra-clean, ultra-unbusy. Muzak shirred the crisp atmosphere as gently as a French chef might shir a sleepy egg for an early rising guest. I wandered through the deserted 8-bed unit, searching for intensive care. The patients were in their beds, quiet, at peace, at home with all they touched in this calm sea, happy fishes floating, floating. I found myself happily humming along with the Muzak, "Some Enchanted Evening," and stopped in front of a computer console which filled me with a mixture of odd childhood memories of Cape Canaveral and adolescent fears stirred up by 2001. I watched the bright lights blink, the oscilloscope flicker with what looked like something like rows of heartbeats. As I watched, there was an unpleasant buzz from the console. Lights flashed. One of the rows of beats froze in space and time, and like ticker tape, out spewed the pink, blue-gridded tongue of an EKG strip. At that, from a nearby room, out spewed a nurse. She looked at the EKG, looked at the oscilloscope screen, did not look at the patient, and with a mixture of pique and cajolery said to the console, "Shit, Ollie, wake up and get it together, will you, for Christ's sakes?" As if for punishment, she poked a few keys fortissimo, which sent the thing humming along again, almost in syncopation with the fresh aria from Muzak, a samba, "When They Begin, the Begin." Relieved to see a warm-blooded being in this freaky reptilian lab, I turned to her and said, "Hi, I'm Roy Bash." "The new turn?" she asked suspiciously. "Right. What's this thing?"
"Thing? Not hardly. He's Ollie the computer. Ollie, say hi to Roy Bash, the new turn here."
And with a few prompting punches in the vital parts,
Ollie spewed out a pink, blue-gridded tongue of an EKG strip on which was printed, "Hi, Roy, and welcome. I'm Ollie." I asked the nurse where I could put my things, and she said to follow her. She was dressed in a green cotton operating room wraparound, open in the back from neck nape to lumbar four, that region of the back where the spine begins to make a delicious contrapunto curve into what used to be a tail, and what now begins the beginning of the fullness of the upper insertion of the gluteus maximus, the ass. As she walked, her spine traced imaginary curves in the MICU space. How fitting, I thought, that these firm young muscles, bathed in Muzak, should dance together so perfectly in neurophysiological sync. There's nothing more magnificent than the human body, and by now you are an expert in dealing with it. The small staff room was filled with nurses, donuts, and gossip. My arrival punctured the bubble of chat, and out leaked silence. Then Angel, the angel of the runt, stood up, came over to me, gave me a hug, and said, "I want to," a gesture toward me, "introduce Roy Bash, the medical intern. I told," gesture toward the nurses, "them about," gesture toward me, "you. We're," gesture toward heaven, "glad you're," gesture toward earth, "here. Wanna," gesture toward donuts. "Donut?" I chose cream-filled. Forgetting work, I eased into this friendly group, relieved that things were so relaxed. I flipped my mind flop to off. The gossip was about the resident in charge of the unit, Joe. In the weeks she'd been there, Joe had amazed, frightened, and ultimately antagonized the nurses, in that archaic pattern still so familiar when women doctors worked with women nurses. Although Joe usually started her own pre-rounds rounds before usual, on this particular day she was nowhere to be seen. "She spent all last night, her night off, here," said a nurse. "She sat up with Mrs. Peedley, wondering why Peedley was still alive. And the only thing wrong with Peedley, really, is Joe's treatment of her. She must have overslept. Will she be mad?" Joe came in sizzling. She looked at me suspiciously, remembering our debacle when Chuck and the runt and I had tormented her on the upstairs ward. But she stuck out her jaw and stuck out her hand and said, "Hi, Roy. Welcome aboard. Never mind what happened upstairs. You'll like it here. It's high-powered medicine. Tight ship. The tightest ship in the whole house. Fresh start. No gripes, no hard feelings, huh?" "No hard feelings, Joe," I said. "Good. Cardiology's my specialty. I'm going on my fellowship to the NIH in Bethesda in July, so stick with me and you'll learn an incredible amount. In the unit, we've got total control of all cardiac parameters. It's high pressure, but if we work hard, we save lives, and we have good fun. Let's go." Just as Joe, the head nurse, and I were wheeling the chart rack to the first room, in skipped Pincus, the consultant to the unit, ready to start his teaching rounds. Pincus was a tall, emaciated-looking staff cardiologist, heading toward 40. A TERF from the U of Arizona to the BMS and the House of God, Pincus was a legend, fanatic in his personal and professional life. Pincus, it was said, rarely left the house. I myself had seen him, night after night, prowling the corridors in the guise of following up on consults on cardiac patients. Whatever the hour, I had found him patient, helpful, courteous, ready to produce an article, ready to put in a pacemaker, ready to chat. Such was his dedication to being in the house that an apocrypha had arisen about his home life. Married, with three daughters, it was rumored that the only way that his wife or daughters knew he'd been home was to notice the toilet seat flipped to the up mode. The other part of Pincus's fanaticism was his obsession with cardiac risk factors. Smoking, coffee, obesity, high blood pressure, saturated fats, cholesterol, and lack of exercise were like death to him. Rumored at one time to have been sedentary, anxious, overweight, stuffing donuts and slurping coffee, Pincus now, through much effort, was on the verge of emaciation, was phobic of cholesterol, and had run himself into incredible shape. For the past 2 years, finishing close to the time of 3 hours in the April marathon. Somehow, Pincus had managed to reduce the final risk factor variable, personality type. In a total turnabout, he'd